It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope that you'll rate, review, and subscribe to this one and share it with your friends if you find it of interest. Today, I have a conversation for you with J.D. Vance, the new nominee from the state of Ohio for the U.S. Senate. As a Republican, he's someone who has certainly attracted the attention nationally of a lot of different people because he represents such a unique brand of potentially Trumpism without Donald Trump himself. He obviously had the backing of the former president and used it to great effect when it came to winning his contentious primary for the key Ohio Senate seat. And he's the odds-on favorite to win that seat in what many expect to be a tsunami of a Republican year that leads them to take back the Senate. So what does he plan to do with that opportunity? And how does he intend to shake up Washington? I spoke to J.D. Vance about this and other issues at length. J.D. Vance, coming up next.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow Podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
J.D. Vance, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Well, thanks for having me, Ben.
I am curious what it feels like to have gone from a situation where you were essentially, you know, active in various ways in the American experience, to writing a book, to potentially being the next senator from one of the most significant states in the country. How does that feel?
Well, it feels pretty surreal. I definitely wake up and think, you know, what an incredible journey I've had in 37 years to have had all these opportunities. And, you know, I think it's a pretty cool testament to the country and to its possibilities. But yeah, you know, it's the cool thing about my life, or I guess a cool thing about my life, is that it's given me a perspective from a lot of different parts of, you know, the country. I've seen sort of, you know, the Appalachian part of our country, the Midwestern part of our country, the elite part of our country, and sort of business and public policy and media. And I think it's definitely, you know, it prepared me in at least a unique way. And we'll see how well it prepared me when, you know, 6 years from now, you can tell me how good of a senator I've been.
Yuval Levin told me that he gave you the worst advice that anybody could ever have given anyone, which was not to write your book. I don't know that he's being self-deprecating or if that's something that actually happened, but I committed myself to asking you the next time I talked to you whether that was true.
It was true. Yeah. Yuval is a friend and suggested that I actually not write the book and that I sort of, you know, wait a little longer and basically come up with something that was a little bit more substantive, frankly, and a little bit less personal. I think, you know, there's definitely wisdom in what Yuval was saying. I mean, I think it's very hard to write a memoir in a way that isn't, you know, either, I think, too self-critical or too self, you know, aggrandizing maybe is the right way to think about it. And I'm not sure that I succeeded on either of those accounts, but I do think there's something to be said for actually waiting and reflecting a little bit before you write about any topic, whether it's your own life or something else. I also think there's something to be said for writing about it when the memories are still fresh and you haven't, you know, completely processed everything, because then it's a little bit more raw and a little bit more truthful. And I do think that was true of my book, certainly very raw and very truthful. And I think that's one of the reasons why it resonated with people.
You don't have any plans to model yourself after Barack Obama and write a second one now, do you?
You know, it's funny. You know, I've always been kind of a writer, so I always have. The problem is nobody's probably going to want to publish my thoughts these days because, you know, when you write a personal story, even if you're a very conservative person, it's not threatening, right? If you think about the publishing industry as a pretty liberal place, you know, Josh Hawley wrote this book about big tech that was kind of censored and you know, his original book deal was canceled. And I think it's sort of indicative of where the publishing industry, like so much of the media, is today. So I'm always writing, and I haven't written a book length thing in a long time, and maybe I never will again. But I'd love to keep on, you know, putting pen to paper. Obviously, political campaign is occupying me these days, but never say never. But man, even if I did finish the book, I don't know that anybody would want to publish it.
Do you judge politicians who obviously rely on ghostwriters?
I have not read enough books that were obviously written by ghostwriters, so I'll spare my judgment for now.
I mean, obviously the most prominent was probably, you know, the Hillary Clinton book that she wrote, you know, like in, I mean, it would have, someone did the calculations at the time, but basically she would have had to be writing like nonstop every day in order to have written the book that, that she wrote.
Was this the one that came out right after Bill left the White House?
Yes. This is something that like is, it's an ever-present element of political life. You have these books that come out from politicians and they're clearly not written by them. And they may have given the various, you know, outlines for what it was going to take, but you know, you obviously are someone who is a writer and wants to write from your own voice. Do you think that you would, will you still try to write if you were elected to the Senate in November on the things that are of importance to you? Do you think that's something that you still want to undertake in the same way that, you know, frankly, you know, lots of politicians historically have done?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whether it's essays or books, I'm a writer, and it's never been a full-time profession for me, but I've always liked to put pen to paper. That was true when I was 14 years old. I think it'll be true until the day that I die. That said, here's an interesting spin or thought about the way in which the publishing industry doesn't really work with political life. And I say this like, you know, there are some good books that have been written by politicians, but if you can write a 300-page book without uttering a single thought that would get you in trouble in the context of a political campaign, you're probably a sociopath. Right. Like everybody who's going to write 300 pages should hopefully have a thought that's far enough out there to justify being published in the first place. And I do think the incentives of being a politician, like if I had known that I was going to run for political office in 2022, right, 6 years after Hillbilly Elegy came out, I never would have written that book, or at least I wouldn't have written it in the same way. Mm-hmm. And I definitely read some politician books, whether written by ghostwriters or not, where it's like very clear that a person is trying to stay within a very narrow Overton window. But if that is like a main goal that you have in mind, then you probably shouldn't be writing a book, right? It's just going to be really boring and useless. Yeah. And so hopefully if I do ever write another book, it's at least courageous enough that it'll be interesting to read, but it'll probably come with some political downsides if it actually is courageous.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite American politician book, and you can't answer U.S. Grant's autobiography, because that's the easiest answer?
Oh, okay, well that is an easy answer. I really like Josh Hawley's book on Teddy Roosevelt. And it's like pretty fascinating because it's clear that he admires Teddy Roosevelt, but it's also clear that he sees some downsides to his like political project. So it's not just this like, oh, Teddy Roosevelt is great and we should all, you know, learn the lessons of Teddy Roosevelt and apply them in the 21st century. I think that's probably the one that comes to mind, just because it's actually written by a thoughtful person, but a person who has complex views on the subject, which is always useful.
Mm-hmm. You know, I do agree with you on that. It's an interesting argument, but I do have to take up some issue with his framing of Roosevelt in his Compact article recently, where he talked about Roosevelt as someone who didn't seek to outsource U.S. sovereignty. From my perspective, that's something that was a real mark of a problem with Roosevelt's approach, in the sense that, you know, from 1905 on, you know, he was essentially seeking to outsource the project of world peace in a way that I feel is very much in keeping with modern progressives and the kind of lead from behind Obamaism that we really can't trust. Tell me a little bit about that dynamic within the context of the current foreign policy discussion on the right, because it seems to me that this is something that's very important to get right, that, you know, has a lot of positive trends in good directions. But I really want to resist the return to a kind of Obamaism that basically says, you know, America should just take a back seat on these things and outsource things to either the EU or to other international entities, as opposed to charting the path forward for the world.
Yeah, so bracket the Teddy Roosevelt part of that, because the thing about historical figures, especially, you know, Teddy Roosevelt is well over a century. We're a century past his influence on American politics. I think that there is a way in which you could take something that's 120 years old and, you know, mold it and rationalize it in a way that can fit any argument today. I mean, I think it's always sure. One of the risks of appealing to history. And since I'm not an expert on Teddy Roosevelt, I won't try to do that with him in the positive or negative direction. I guess I think that to me the central question of American foreign policy is not the pro-Obama or the, you know, Obamaism versus some other ism. And so it's a little bit like it's not the frame that I would put on it, I guess.
Okay.
I tend to think the proper frame is the entire American foreign policy establishment has been broadly aligned on what we should be doing in the post-war era. And obviously there have been some big disagreements. But if you think of, like, you know, most people agreed that the Vietnam War was justified based on some sort of domino theory. Most people agreed that the first Gulf War was justified. Most people think that the Iraq War was justified, the Afghanistan conflict, whatever you want to call it. And I think that, you know, that while those people haven't been wrong all the time, they've been wrong a lot. And I think that in some ways, what made a lot of sense in the 1950s in American foreign policy just doesn't make sense in 2022 anymore. So I guess I see this less as a conversation between Obama and conservatives in the last 15 years, and more as a sort of broad shift in how Americans should understand, like, what is in our national interest, what institutions are actually useful in pursuing that national interest, and more importantly, how have the ways in which American opinion makers form their opinions, like, how has it been corrupted by, like what, I don't want to say because I'd just be guessing, but it seems to me that the way in which foreign policy leaders make decisions in America is horribly broken. The evidence is in what we've done as a foreign policy establishment for the last 30 years. Almost all of it, I think, has been bad.
Mm-hmm. There's a corruption of purpose and there's a corruption of execution. Is the problem that we have within the foreign policy NATSEC space, is it more on one side or the other of that? Meaning, is the purpose right and the execution bad? Or is the purpose wrong and the execution bad? Because I don't think that anyone can make the argument effectively that the execution has been good.
You know, the easy thing is to say that both have been bad, or maybe the purpose has been okay, but the execution has been bad. I mean, I think the purpose itself has been pretty bad too, right? Mm-hmm. Like just stick today. So today I saw a story that the U.S. Embassy in the Holy See, the Vatican, right? Sort of one of the most socially conservative religious organizations in the world.
Yes, I saw this
hoisted,
as well.
Yeah, and hoisted the LGBT flag outside of its grounds. Or to take an even more extreme example, I know that the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan, was, you know, pushing various forms of American social progressivism. There is this weird way where, I mean, look, whatever your views are on gay rights or, you know, the particular social issues of the day, we should have a little bit of diplomacy and maybe not take American ideas into places like Kabul that are extremely unpopular. And at the end of the day, you know, it doesn't serve our national interest to sort of project that particular worldview onto a culture that's very different. I think, you know, most reasonable people, even if you're pro-gay rights, think that you should have a little bit of sensitivity when it comes to dealing with, you know, a very extremist, largely conservative Islamic society.
Yeah.
So
when John Huntsman was the ambassador to China, I believe he drank the baiju. Like, I mean, you have to go through certain social customs in order to navigate.
Exactly. Right. And I guess my instinct is that a lot of the foreign policy establishment has been trying to pursue an American social agenda on the world stage rather than a very hard-nosed, realistic, what is in our national interests and to try to pursue that on the world stage. So I think the purposes and the execution have both been flawed.
You know, one of the things that I am curious about, though, if that's the take that you have, and I agree with it largely, how does that change? Because one senator, a senator from Ohio, or even combined with a senator from Missouri or a senator from here, there, or the other place, you don't actually have the capability to change that swamp. You can be an outpost of sanity within a world of foreign policy influencers who will attack you and seek to undermine you and depict you as being, you know, everything from a traitor to someone compromised by a foreign nation. I mean, we've seen all of that happen. You know, I mean, Rand Paul tends to be the biggest lightning rod on this kind of thing, but, right. You know, it certainly happens to lots of members. So how do you change that? Is it a generational shift? Is it coming up with entities and approaches that can credential alternative foreign policy experts and national security practitioners in order to inhabit a future administration? What does it look like in terms of actually changing the direction of this giant blob?
Well, I think it looks like institution building, right? So you're absolutely right that in 2023, can J.D. Vance rationalize American foreign policy 12 months later? Of course, the answer is no. But what I can do is be a beachhead. I can be, you know, a sort of rallying point for people who want to make arguments that the foreign policy blob is not comfortable with. And more importantly, we can start to build the institutions that are necessary to accomplish some long-term shifts in the way that our country does foreign policy. You know, like you said, staff administrations have think tank fellows that are thinking about this stuff in a slightly unorthodox way. I mean, what's interesting, you mentioned Rand Paul, right? So, you know, on this Ukraine sort of question, I've been much closer to Rand Paul than you know, the sort of the center of gravity, let's say, of Republican opinion. Though I've never sort of thought of myself as a non-interventionist in foreign policy. So on a lot of issues, I don't necessarily see myself as aligned with Rand Paul, even though, you know, I think he's been largely right on the Ukraine stuff. But I do think that, like, whether you come from sort of, I'd call myself more of a realist than a non-interventionist, like whatever school of thought you come from, there is a very narrow Overton window of what you're allowed to say about American foreign policy in this country. And that really has to change, because if you believe in the free market of ideas, and I think that, you know, it has some problems, but it's generally better if we're actually debating difficult questions and coming to some sort of resolution on those debates. It's very hard to have a successful debate if you're not even allowed to say half of what you might want to say.
Well, one of the things that I think is certainly front of mind for a lot of people in this moment is basically, you know, why are we investing so much time and energy overseas in a general prospect as opposed to things that we can do back home? And the real struggles that a lot of people are facing economically, challenges that are, you know, emerging from a lot of different policy decisions. What can the Senate do after November, assuming that Republicans are successful, as they're likely to be, yourself included, in terms of making a difference on the next 2 years of policy under this Biden administration that is focused here at home and on trying to improve the domestic realities for Americans? You know, it's one thing to be able to have some kind of bipartisan unanimity when it comes to sending money overseas. But, you know, separate from that, Americans are hurting in a lot of different ways. And I don't really see the plan going forward post-November for what Republicans really intend to do if they have the reins in Congress.
Well, I think it's a mistake, by the way. You're right that it's not clear that Republicans have a plan. And in part, this is by design, right? It's sort of a certain set of figures within the Republican establishment have decided it's easier to run against Joe Biden than it is to run affirmatively for anything. But I think it would be more useful if we could do both. Certainly, you know, in our campaign, we've offered some ideas. We'll continue to offer more about things that we could actually do. Now, you're right that with President Joe Biden or Kamala Harris or whoever, God forbid, the Democrats have in that chair come 2023.
Now you've been talking to my astrologer.
I think that whatever the presidency looks like, it's obviously going to be a Democrat in 2023. Yeah, they're going to veto a lot of these things, right? So there are two separate strategies here, and I think we should pursue both. One is make the president veto popular legislation so that the Democrats have to deal with that political reality in 2024, and we can hopefully get a better president who's going to sign some good pieces of legislation. And the other side is be willing to use our leverage on this, right? I think, for example, that if Republicans had really been willing to use their leverage, especially if we were in the majority, we could have gotten a lot of the vaccine mandate stuff undone by refusing to give Biden spending money for his priorities unless he undid some of the vaccine mandates, right? There is a certain way in which you have to use leverage. And you can't be politically stupid about it, but you have to be willing to play the cards that you were dealt. And I do think that often Republicans, we get outplayed in these political fights, but that's a function of strategy and messaging, and we could do a lot better there.
What happened to Tim Ryan?
You know, look, I as a person who, you know, for example, I was not a fan of Trump in 2016 and, you know, became a fan of Trump. Like, you know, the argument was always lodged against me. Well, this is just political expediency. He feels the same way he did in 2016. I think people can genuinely have.
Can I interject there
Please.
For a second?
Yeah.
To me, that argument is the antithesis of the lessons that we learn from the Big Lebowski. You know, right. new shit has come to light.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, if I'm being charitable, the guy has changed his entire worldview in the last 2 years, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm being uncharitable, I'd say, well, look, it's one thing to change your mind on this or that issue. It's another thing to change your worldview from conservative Democrat to far left Democrat to conservative Democrat in 4 years, right? That's sort of a flip in a 4 year period without any real justification for it. I think that what's happened to Tim is that he, you know, probably was a pretty moderate Democrat 20 or so years ago. He's not an especially thoughtful guy. I mean, this is a crazy stat about Tim Ryan. I didn't even know until I started running this campaign. He's passed 4 bills in his entire time as a legislator. 3 of those were renaming post offices. So he's passed, as I understand it, 1 substantive piece of legislation in 2 decades. I think what's going on with Tim Ryan is he's kind of lazy. He doesn't really think for himself, and he votes with Joe Biden 100% of the time because that's what the Democratic Party tells him to do, and he doesn't have any independence. Like I think more, there's no great ideological mystery here. This is not a guy who's thought deeply about how he feels about anything. I think this is just a guy who's gone along with the trends of the Democratic Party because he doesn't know anything better to do.
The conference that Republicans inhabit in the Senate is likely to be changed significantly by the new membership post-November. In terms of the people who are there, who form kind of a critical mass of younger members, for the most part, people who have different priorities, I mean, it's going to be a sizable portion of the conference. That could make a real mark. How do you organize that and have an actual impact on the way that the institution runs in a way that is, you know, productive and leads to perhaps shift in priorities or in legislation and the like?
You know, there's a formal way and there's an informal way, right? The informal way is that, you know, a few, like one senator with a particular disposition doesn't change a whole lot, but 3, 4, 5 senators with a similar disposition who are young and energetic can just sort of shift the center of gravity of the party, right? You know, you combine some media savvy, some contacts within, you know, the conservative, you know, firmament, and, you know, you try to influence things that way. And then a more formal way would be to try to establish, you know, some sort of caucus or conference, even if it's bicameral, to try to get the people who are thinking somewhat similar things on the same team. And, you know, there's going to be disagreements even with that in that caucus, right? I mean, you know, Josh Hawley and Tom Cotton came down on different ways on the Ukraine stuff, but I think they're very similarly situated on the immigration issue, for example. Mm-hmm. So, and on most issues, I think they're actually in the same camp. So I think that there is this critical mass of Republicans who recognize that we have a set of serious challenges to solve, and frankly recognize that we have a set of voters that the old guard Republican establishment either isn't aware of, or if they're aware of them, they don't like them. And we actually like those people, and we think that they deserve a Republican Party that's responsive to their interests. Mm-hmm.
A final question. The decision that's going to come down from the Supreme Court assuming that it is in keeping with what has been released from Justice Alito, is likely to tear open a lot of different discussion at the state level about abortion policy. There's a lot of establishment Republicans who are pretty scared of that. They were happy with the status quo. You're well aware of this.
Yes.
What should be done and what should pro-life conservatives be doing now in order to prepare for what comes next and to guard against the natural tendency of a lot of Republicans who were happy to check the box as pro-life until it actually mattered, that are probably going to want to run away from fighting this fight in a way that actually represents what the sizable plurality of their constituents, if not majority in some states, want.
Yeah, so before I answer this, I want to just address the politics of this real quick, because I think that the conventional wisdom that this is terrible for Republicans is probably wrong, or at least there's a good chance that it's wrong. Yes, it will energize the left, but you know these people, Ben. I know these people. There are people.
They were all going to vote anyway.
Well, that's right. But I know, Ben, I know 60-year-old women at my church who don't care about the Republican Party one stitch. They vote Republican and have for 40 years because of the abortion issue. And those people are going to be energized too. Mm-hmm. So the politics of this, I think, are going to be a little bit more complicated than a lot of the left assumes, or at least hopes. And what do we do? So I think on the one hand, this becomes a state issue, right? In states, and I hope Ohio will legislate in a way that protects the rights of the unborn. But the one argument that the left makes about abortion that I at least, I think is half fake, but it's somewhat true, is that with conservative politicians, not pro-life interest groups, the pro-life groups are the most generous and the most kind with women who are dealing with unplanned pregnancies of anybody I know in the entire world. But there is this way in which politicians like to talk about abortion, but don't have the same level of compassion when we're talking about maybe a six-month-old baby. What do you do with a mom who's dealing with an unplanned pregnancy? You can't just say, well, yeah, I agree with this, that the mom shouldn't abort the baby, but then there has to be a plan afterwards. And I do think that those of us who are in political leadership could actually take a page from the pro-life movement, right? From the Susan B. Anthony's lists of the world, and actually have a real pro-family, a pro-child set of priorities that make a lot of young women feel like, these people aren't just anti-abortion, they're pro-life at every step of the way. And I think if we do that, we can win the messaging battle, but also do a lot of good.
It seems to me like this is going to be a fight that a lot of people never thought would come, so are not really prepared for it. Do you feel like that's going to lead to a worse outcome, or do you have faith that this is something that we can adjudicate in a federalist manner and not have things spiral out of control in terms of the kinds of protests that you've seen in front of the Supreme Court justices' houses and the like?
I'm not exactly hopeful about our federal institutions or even our state institutions on a lot of things. I think we have a very broken leadership class in this country. That said, I think some of the people who are involved, at least on the conservative side in the abortion debate, are some of the best people in our movement. And I think that they're going to be pretty good stewards and pretty good advocates for the stage that comes next. So on this issue, maybe more than most others, I think that we're going to come to a pretty good set of policies. And I think the outcome is not going to be nearly as catastrophic as a lot of people fear.
I'm hopeful as well. J.D. Vance, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks, man. See ya.
I was interested to see the outcome in the Johnny Depp Amber Heard defamation case for a number of reasons. This wasn't just a celebrity sideshow that dominated cable news airwaves and was certainly the spark for a lot of different discussions about relationships, Me Too, and other key issues at the center of American relations between men and women. It was also interesting for a number of other reasons. One is, of course, defamation lawsuits along these lines are very difficult to win historically in the United States. You have to prove a lot of different things. And of course, Amber Heard had already prevailed in a case that happened in the UK, where supposedly the standard is, essentially much lower when it came to pursuing such a case. Now, there were some key differences in those cases, key differences both in the evidence that the jury was allowed to hear and and a number of other factors related to it. But it certainly was amazing to see this whole tableau play out in front of us, considering where it actually came from. Of all places, it came from the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, who wrote and drafted the offending op-ed in question, which ran in the Washington Post, collaborated on it with Heard, made the very odd media decision of using the hook of her prominent role in the Aquaman movie as a reason to publish it, and had designs on a massive fundraising windfall from her divorce settlement that she was offering, $3.5 million that was intended to go to the ACLU. Laura Bazelon, a professor, has a piece at The Atlantic which delves into a lot of the different aspects of this that were so weird, involving Elon Musk, involving the exchange of a lot of different promises and the like. But the thing that I think is so key to understand about this is how the ACLU has completely decayed to the point where it's in many respects, as she writes, become a caricature of its former self. Over the organization's 100-year history, she writes, the ACLU's unique value has been its apolitical willingness to stand up for all speech, regardless of the speaker's identity, and to stand up for those accused, no matter what the accusation. This content-neutral take all comers stance is based on the premise that the silencing of one side will inevitably lead to a collective hush irreconcilable with the free marketplace of ideas and the commitment to due process that are the hallmarks of our democracy. Doing this often unpopular work turns on the belief that having an informed and independent-minded citizenry requires the ability to countenance, analyze, and yes, at times defend opposing points of view. To me, the fact that the ACLU became such a player in this is an indication of the changed nature of the left in a big way. So many aspects of civil liberty focused people in recent years have shifted ideologically away from the left and to the right, that you now see people routinely accused of being conservatives simply because of where they end up on the spectrum of the civil liberty related issues, when if you rewound to the 1990s, for instance, it would firmly plant them as being a left of center person. Bill Maher is obviously a prominent example of this. Joe Rogan is an example of this. But it's also an indication that I think in the wake of the 2016 election and the experience under Donald Trump, a lot of people thought that the liberal or sort of left of center view was going to be one that perhaps dabbled in some craziness when it came to embrace of woke ideology or leaning more toward an authoritarian approach to things out of desperation or resistance, dynamics or something along those lines. But to me, it's an indication that this is a development that is probably going to have more permanence, where civil liberties are no longer something that is associated with the left in any meaningful way. And instead, what they have to offer the American people is an agenda that has a lot more to do with the enforcement of a harsh ideological regime, as opposed to an acceptance of the idea that it's a good thing in order to defend the rights of people to say things, even if you disagree with them. I'm Ben Domenech. This has been another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by founder and executive director of Power the Future, Daniel Turner, for a look at how we can advocate for a cleaner earth while strengthening U.S. energy independence. Available now on foxnewspodcast.com.